Hello, friends. This is the Environment Show, and welcome.
We're going to have to bite a big bullet. It's not going to be cheap. But, again, consider the alternative. You know, if we don't have this fragile blue-white gem, this water planet named Earth, then we don't have a place to live. We don't live. We die.
Distance-wise, in taking the path of the spill and transposing it on a map of the East Coast, the coastline damaged would stretch from Cape Cod in Massachusetts to Cape Hatteras in North Carolina. I know Alaska is big, and sometimes people have a hard time grasping how big, but as a comparison, imagine a spill hitting that much of the East Coast. That's how much we got hit.
Popular music show host Robert J. Lertzema. From WGBH in Boston, Lertzema is presenting a series of music programs on environmental themes this year, and we'll talk to him about his music and his message. And Anne Rothy of the National Wildlife Federation's Anchorage, Alaska office. She walked along the shoreline after the wreck of the Exxon Valdez a year ago, March 24th. That's all this week on The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC and is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. This week, it was reported that workers in San Diego repairing the supertanker Exxon Valdez painted over portions of the hull, including the name, as if to take away the soul of the ship, as if to block out the memory. The ship is now but a gray, and one might almost say ghostly, leviathan. Though one may no longer be able to see the name, it will be remembered virtually forever. For shortly after midnight, on March 24th of 1989, Good Friday, the 987-foot supertanker, laden with 1.25 million barrels of North Slope crude oil, struck Bligh Reef, about 25 miles south of Valdez, Alaska. From a hole ripped in the ship's hull, 11 million gallons, or 260,000 barrels of oil, flowed out into Prince William Sound. Within a few weeks, the oil had spread down along the coast of the Sound and beyond. 1,100 miles of coast affected.
Distance-wise, in taking the path of the spill and transposing it on a map of the East Coast, the coastline damaged would stretch from Cape Cod in Massachusetts to Cape Hatteras in North Carolina.
Anne Rothy is regional director of the National Wildlife Federation office in Anchorage, Alaska.
I know Alaska is big, and sometimes people have a hard time grasping how big, but as a comparison, imagine a spill hitting that much of the East Coast. That's how much we got hit.
Anne Rothy flew over the Sound a few weeks after the spill and later walked along the rocks. She tells us what she saw.
The most lasting impression, obviously, is the amount of oil on the beaches. In some places, the smell of the aromatic portion of the oil was so strong as to be nauseating even when you flew over it in an airplane. I mean, you could scent that coming up through the windows of the airplane. So that was overwhelming. That was just a really strong impression. And then when you got out on the beaches, boy, it's almost hard to imagine, but the smell is nauseating and overwhelming, and in some places the oil was pooled up, in some cases more than 12 inches deep on the intertidal zone. Very shortly after the storm hit, after day three, that oil was emulsified. A lot of the aromatic portion evaporated, and it mixed with water and became a light brown, sticky, gooey, we call it mousse for lack of a better way to describe it. But that mousse was a totally different sort of compound than the fresh oil. It was just a very sticky, gooey, entrapping sort of substance that once wildlife hit it and got immersed in it, it was all over. I mean, there were birds covered with mousse all over the beaches. It was a pretty horrifying sight.
Cleanup crews did not exactly rush to the scene. In fact, in the debate that has raged over the past year, one point that has frequently been raised is that had the response been quicker, perhaps the oil would never have reached the shore to begin with. But that, of course, was not the case. Instead, as awesome a sight as the ship and its grounded cargo were, the images that stick in our mind today are those of workers clambering over the rocks, trying to clean up the oil, sometimes using rags and paper towels, a desperate and hopeless effort.
Once oil hits the beach, there wasn't any technology that could get it up. The steam hot water technology cleaned some oil off surface rocks, but it drove a lot more into the substrate, so that even after that cleanup effort, even after a whole winter of storms pounding on the most exposed beaches, we still have what we call bleeder beaches, that is, beaches that are releasing sheens of oil, even though as you look at the surface, you don't see the oil immediately. You dig down 3 or 4 inches, and it's there. So if any other message gets across to the rest of the country, the message they need to hear is that the oil is not gone. It's going to be in this environment for a very long time, being released slowly, having a long-term, what we call sublethal effect on the ecosystem. It's, those hydrocarbons are going to be there, being absorbed by the animals in the environment, probably causing reduced reproductive rates for many salmon, shellfish, the basic components of the food chain. It's there, and it's going to stay there for a while.
We've learned that we can no longer trust the oil companies that tell us that we don't have to worry about catastrophic spills and that they have the technology to clean them up.
Eric Olson, counsel for the Environmental Quality Programs at the National Wildlife Federation office in Washington.
Those are two very painful lessons that we've learned, that it's in fact not true that they can avoid catastrophic oil spills, and it's in fact a falsehood that people can control the spills and clean them up afterwards.
Olson is one of the legal counsels with the National Wildlife Federation as it filed litigation in Alaska State Supreme Court against Exxon Corporation and the Alyeska pipeline over the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Olson says, as a result of this spill, we have learned at least two important lessons.
One is to really crack down on the oil companies and make sure that they have contingency plans and all the equipment that they promise ready to go, and also that it's being put out almost immediately after the spill, because as we saw in the Valdez situation, you really have to get out almost as soon as the oil hits the water if you want to have any prayer of containing the spill.
Olson says that there is also a clear need for double hulling on these huge ships, something that is not now required, though legislation before Congress could change that, this under a bill sponsored by New Jersey Representative Dean Gallo. The other thing Olson says we have learned is that there needs to be significant and enforceable fines levied against those responsible for damaging the ecosystem should there be an oil spill. Enough not only for cleanup and restoration efforts, but more importantly, to act as an incentive to avoid spills in the first place. Ann Rothy says that the accident was caused not by one skipper on one supertanker, or even by one oil company. It was caused, she says, by the oil-demanding American consumer, our rapacious appetite for oil, for energy, what necessitated the Alyeska pipeline to begin with. Now, Rothy says, if we are demanding safer methods of shipping the crude, we are going to have to pay for the technology to do so. In Alaska, though, today, she says there is more going on beyond just simply dollars and cents.
I think probably one of the most important things that we have done is here in Alaska put together a citizens advisory group that has entered into a contract with the Alyeska Consortium, that is the seven owner companies of Alyeska, to provide thorough oversight of the operations of that terminal. And by oversight, I mean monitoring the air quality and water quality problems associated with terminal operations, looking at the vessel traffic system and safety measures, looking at the oil spill prevention and response plan that Alyeska is now revising and rewriting, and tracking each and every one of those activities. The basic premise behind the formation of this group is that those citizens most directly affected by the actions of the industry in Prince William Sound have a right to be involved in the decisions of the industry. And that is, for us, a major step forward for the industry to acknowledge that we have a right to be involved, to give us access to the terminal so that we can provide that oversight And I think that action sets a precedent for every other oil transport facility in the country.
Other measures, Rothy says, are being implemented, seeking a mandated double hull for tankers, leaving the channel escort pilot aboard the tanker all the way out to the open sea, and reducing the speed to 10 knots, giving the ship a longer response time in the event of an emergency situation. Exxon Corporation, as yet not returning our calls on this piece, faces not just a few major legal challenges, some from individual fishermen and affected citizens in the Prince William Sound area, some from the state of Alaska itself, and recently a 5-count indictment handed up against the corporation by the federal government. If Exxon is convicted on all counts, criminal fines could total as much as $1.6 million. In addition, an official with the United States Attorney General Dick Thornburgh's office says the government may also seek as much as $700 million more dollars under a federal law that allows the government to collect twice the amount of the amount proven lost in the spill. The Exxon Valdez tanker accident dominated the news about oil spills last year, no doubt, but a 12-year study recently published shows that 1989 actually comparatively had fewer spills, even though there was a record amount of oil involved. The study released by Golub's Oil Pollution Bulletin says there were 5 accidents involving oil spills of more than 10,000 gallons last year. That is substantially less than the 16 accidents logged in 1979, slightly below the average of 6 to 7 per year. The report by Richard Golub of Cambridge, Massachusetts, says that after the Exxon spill of March 24th, 3 months later, accidents in Rhode Island and in Delaware, within a day of each other, spilled a total of 720,000 gallons. 2 other spills in Hawaii and Port Valdez, Alaska, accounted for an additional 104,000 gallons spilled last year. Well, a few weeks ago, we told you about a new code of conduct being adopted by many corporations called the Valdez Principles. The code is a list of 10 resolutions a company might make with respect to the environment. Now, we've had many inquiries about this, so we thought we might share it with you again on this date close to the anniversary of the Valdez oil spill itself. The Valdez Principles, to wit, on protection of the biosphere, we will minimize and strive to eliminate the release of any pollutant that may cause environmental damage to the air, water, or earth, or its inhabitants. On the sustainable use of natural resources, we will conserve non-renewable natural resources through efficient use and careful planning. 3. Reduction and disposal of waste, we will minimize the creation of waste. We will dispose of all wastes through safe and responsible methods. And we will make every effort to use environmentally safe and sustainable energy sources to meet our needs. And 5, on risk reduction, we will minimize the environmental, health, and safety risks to our employees and the communities. And on marketing of safe products and services, we resolve to sell products or services that minimize adverse environmental impacts. 7, we will take responsibility for any harm we cause to the environment. And on disclosure, 8, we will disclose to our employees and to the public incidents relating to our operations that cause environmental harm or pose health or safety hazards. And at least one member of the board of directors of our corporation will be a person qualified to represent environmental interests. And finally, 10, we will conduct and make public an annual self-evaluation of our progress in implementing these principles. One final note on all of this today. Ann Rothy of the Wildlife Federation office in Anchorage tells us that for all the attention paid to the coastline, the oil spill, and the oil terminal, we are overlooking the biggest problem of all. Carrying the oil from the North Slope, the pipeline itself is already deteriorating and is a disaster waiting. You're listening to The Environment Show, and this is Bruce Robertson. It was a bad week for environmentalists pushing for a new clean air bill. The U.S. Senate voted down 3 amendments to the compromise bill. One observer said, 3 strikes and you're out. Political sparring is always complex, but essentially what has happened is this. The original bill, S-1630, contained certain clauses. In congressional jargon, they are called titles. These were removed, or at least changed somewhat, during those closed-door debates we told you about a few weeks ago. Then what happened is that certain environmental senators added, or at least tried to add back, portions deleted or altered in those secret negotiations. There were 3 key moves, and on all 3, environmentalists lost. Defeated was a proposal to require tougher tailpipe emission controls on cars. It lost 52-46. Also defeated, a proposal to reduce other toxic chemical emissions from cars. This amendment by New Jersey Senator Lautenberg went down 65 to 33, with five Democratic senators switching votes from their initial indications. Voting against it were Senators Joseph Biden of Delaware, Kent Conrad of North Dakota, Senator Fowler of Georgia and Sam Nunn of Georgia, and Senator Terry Sanford from North Carolina. Then, by a vote of 53 to 46, the so-called Kerry-Wilson Amendment to fight urban smog also lost. This would have extended pollution controls to smaller businesses. On all three, Senate strategists, including Majority Leader George Mitchell, decided that taking on the extra baggage might sink the whole ship altogether. Chris Ballantyne is Northeast Regional Director of the Sierra Club, and he's been lobbying and observing these proceedings with increasing dismay.
We knew that we had a very rough road to win these amendments. We were going head-to-head with big oil and big automobile companies and polluters of all sorts. Plus, we were also going head-to-head with the administration and the Democratic and Republican leadership. Those are pretty tough odds, by and large.
The action on the House side has been, in a sense, waiting the outcome of what's happening in the Senate. Are these the defeats now meaning anything, you suppose, for action on the House side?
Well, it means from the environmental standpoint that we'll have to redouble our efforts to secure strengthening amendments, probably on the House floor. The benefit to that is that it is a lot easier to influence a single member of Congress than it is to influence a senator, for example.
The question we've been asking, I guess, all through this, as amendments have been added and then voted down or debated anyway, what seems to be the problem? Is it still an economic question, or is it people not believing the major overall policies that, for example, the toxic emissions are not at the levels that some claim, that the auto emissions are not at levels that some claim, or is it simply a financial matter?
Well, I think the Clean Air Working Group and Forces of Evil, if you will, would say that it is an economic problem. We see it as a special interest problem. And individual industries that are opposed to these provisions are lobbying in force. I might say that I think they are probably outnumbering us 4 or 5 to 1.
From what you know and have been observing, who seems to be the key players in voting down these amendments? In other words, what's holding this up?
Well, ironically, it's been a lot of our friends that have had to lead the charge to defeat these strengthening amendments. Senator Mitchell, who is a pretty good environmentalist in his own right, has had to support the compromise to maintain his end of the deal, and he's had to speak against it and twist arms of Democratic senators to vote against these key amendments. On the Republican side, Senator John Chafee has also had to do that. And the administration has been very successful in twisting arms. So ironically, it's some of our friends that are forced to hold up their ends of the compromise.
Mm-hmm. Chris, let me ask you then, political operations being that of compromise and adjustments, what would be wrong with, at this point, going along with some of these changes and amendments and strikedowns of amendments if that meant getting a clean air bill passed? After all, it's been 10 years or more since we've had one updated and made official on the books. Is it better not to have something, better to have something than not have anything at all?
That's a tough question, Bruce, and I'm sure it's one that we're going to be debating over the several next few days. My perception is if we can get a good bill, that's where the environmental community would be happy. The amendments that have been introduced heretofore and agreed to will undermine some of the key provisions of the original Clean Air Act. And it's a question of saying if you get a good acid rain title, can you live with a bad smog title and a potential terrible air toxics title? I don't know if it all balances out.
Classic Greek dilemma.
Yes.
Well, Chris, thanks for joining us and bringing us up to date again. Chris Ballantyne, Northeast Regional Director of the Sierra Club, reporting and observing things as a lobbyist and a reporter for us of sorts for the Environment Show. And we'll talk to you again next week, Chris.
Thanks, Bruce.
Representing the Motor Vehicle Manufacturing Association, Tim McCarthy, Director of Federal Relations, says that his association is opposed to the Wilson-Worth Amendment to tighten auto emission controls because, he says, better we should be spending our time and money developing an alternative fuels program.
We were suggesting to look in that area, and we were suggesting a sizable program in that area long before many who are promoting it now were. We were quite excited about the possibilities that might exist in the area of alternate fuels, but we're still also somewhat cautious because we don't want to hop out of the frying pan and into the fire. We want to make sure that whatever alternate fuel program we go with, that it doesn't create similar or worse problems than the one we're leaving.
In addition, says McCarthy, we are already driving cars that are significantly cleaner than the ones we had back in 1970.
Our position is that the cars we produce today are extremely clean. The tailpipe pollutants now average as much as 96% cleanup from pre-controlled levels. What this argument is about presently is the last few percentages of cleanup. What people don't realize is that a lot of the environmental groups talk about we need another 60% cleanup, but it's not a 60% cleanup from a baseline of zero. It's from a baseline of only 4% more to clean up.
Tim McCarthy, Director of Federal Relations at the Motor Vehicle Manufacturing Association. You're listening to The Environment Show, and this is Bruce Robertson. As our consciousness of environmental crises grows ever deeper, so our search for solutions grows ever broader. Inasmuch as we are all part of the problem and potentially the solution, so too are the many voices being heard, politicians and scientists, concerned citizens, and yes, even the news media, and artists of all sorts, graphic and performing. Consider the case of Robert J. Lertzema. Lertzema hosts a daily classical music program from the studios of WGBH in Boston. It is called Morning Pro Musica, and it is an eclectic program of classical music from all the nations of the world, a program that he describes as interspersed with news, weather, and commentary. The program each day opens with bird songs in meadows and forests and broadcasts each day to millions of listeners all around New England and eastern New York. With his low, measured style of speaking, Lertzema commands no slight power when it comes to influencing listeners, which he has been doing since June of 1971. In all of his nearly 19 years on the air with the program, Lertzema has maintained ecological themes and concerns, on at least one occasion traveling with saxophone player Paul Winter down the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon. This year, the year of Earth Day 1990, his focus is sharpening and his excitement rising.
It's good to have you here on the Environment Show. Obviously, that's what we're talking about. It's probably, to most people, an odd pairing to think of your show, which is essentially classical music and world's classical music, not only the Western tradition. But how could you describe your concept of how music, classical music in this case, has anything to say and work with environmental issues?
Classical music is something that we preserve. We preserve it by learning the pieces and performing them, or by listening to them, by buying records. And that sense of preservation is one, I think, that carries over into environmental concerns. We are we don't protect the planet we've got. We don't have an environment in which to enjoy music or anything else.
What concerns you the most?
I think overpopulation, unquestionably. I think that it is the single most difficult problem with which to deal. It is, I think, natural for any species to want to survive. And, I mean, the fundamental of existence is survival, and survival is dependent on reproduction. One need only look at the way a tree can cling to a little cleft in a stone face to, you know, see the how that works. And to tell people, hey, you know, you got to cut back. Look what happened in China. But China, which has an enormous population, has recognized the peril, and they've chosen to do something about it. Now, people don't like it, and you can understand why people don't like it. But think of the alternative. There are other countries where that are going to outstrip China in population in just a few short decades because they don't have any curbs on the population. India, for example, And that, if you think of what that means in terms of the impoverishment and the incredible drain on the resources of the planet, then there are a lot of serious problems: air pollution and acid rain and waste disposal and the greenhouse effect and things like that. But I would say that overpopulation has to rank number one, mm-hmm. and has to be one of the things that somehow or other we find a way to tackle early on.
Robert, let me ask you then, are you hopeful on any one of these crises that face us? Are you hopeful of solutions or turning things around?
Yeah, there are always solutions for problems. You have to believe that. You have to have a sense of optimism. And I do. I think that, we're very intelligent creatures. We're not omniscient. But luckily, we have the wherewithal to use our gray matter constructively. That's what's got us to where we are. And it also offers us the opportunity to turn away from some of the wrong paths and head down the right ones. We're going to have to bite a big bullet. It's not going to be cheap. But, again, consider the alternative. You know, if we don't have this fragile blue-white gem, this water planet named Earth, then we don't have a place to live. We don't live. We die.
Earlier, I asked you if you are hopeful, and you said we always have to be hopeful. What can you say to instill hope in others?
I think probably the most positive thing is that now, in 1990, those of us who 20, 25 years ago were raising our voices and trying to say, hey, Rachel Carson is right, you know, now we're being asked to come and participate in events that people are planning in order to focus more attention on what we've been yelling our brains out about for a long time. And now that's very, very, very positive to see that in 1990, it is not just a few of us. Now it's the world. The world is getting behind it and saying, hey, we've got a real problem and we've got to do something about it.
Robert J. Lertzma, host of Morning Promusica, thank you for joining us this time on The Environment Show.
Thank you.
And that is our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed it. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.